COVID cases continue to rise in Florida. The virus's impacts on foster care and film projects slowly return to our region. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, Sunday saw more than 3,000 positive cases. Hospitalizations are on the rise, but Governor Ron DeSantis has no plans to roll things back. How should we look at the numbers? Also, tens of thousands of children in Florida go through the foster care system every year. The pandemic has made it harder for state workers to investigate child abuse cases. We'll get an inside look at the foster care system under COVID. And finally, South Florida is a popular place for film and television producers to shoot their projects. But between the state not offering much in tax incentives and now a pandemic, will the film industry be able to rebound here? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, today, Florida reached a grim milestone with a total of more than 100,000 COVID-19 cases, and half of those are in South Florida. Last week, we saw four consecutive days with at least 3,000 new people testing positive. And it's not just new cases that are raising concerns. Hospitalizations, the rate of infection, and deaths all come together to give us a full picture. To talk about these numbers and what they mean, we have WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. Veronica, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Luis.
Lots of numbers to digest. So over the weekend, Governor Ron DeSantis said this about the rise in the number of cases.
It's not purely just a function of the fact that they're testing more. Part of it is that, but you are seeing a higher positivity rate. So those are things that we've got to tackle, and we're looking forward to doing that.
So, Veronica, what does the positivity rate mean again?
So the positivity rate is the number of total tests administered in a day divided by how many people tested positive in a day. And the state does separate the number of people who tested positive for the first time from those who are repeat positives, let's say at a hospital, and they need to test many times until they're negative to be discharged.
So last week, the governor said that we're not rolling back when asked about the rising cases. What are the recommendations from health experts about the reopening and this, again, this positivity rate?
Yeah, exactly. There has been, he's mentioned that he's not going to roll back. The thing is that basically, what experts are suggesting is that there needs to be an increase of contact tracing, short of if we don't have medication or a vaccine that will, drastically drop these numbers, then isolating patients from the general public, or people who are testing positive, is a way to enable businesses to operate without there being this huge spike in cases. And that's one place where Florida doesn't seem to have sufficient contact tracers, or that's where experts are seeing that it's a bit unclear where that's heading.
What's Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez said about the possibility of rolling things back?
Well, what he's done, he had a recent press conference where he said right now he's ramping up the oversight of businesses that are not complying with these regulations, where, let's say, inside people need to be wearing masks and there needs to be a certain distance between clients. And so this is going to be one way to get businesses into compliance without having to shut down parts of the economy.
And what did he say about contact tracing?
And we asked him about that at the press conference, and he said that right now he asked a doctor on his team to answer the question, and she said that the county is working with the state on getting enough of the tracers. And so it was not a clear answer where that is. There are some colleges in South Florida, in our region, that are offering contact tracing courses. So it's a bit unclear, what direction, how many are going to be hired by the county versus the state. So that remains to be answered this, you know, in the coming days.
So I've talked to Jimenez many times about this, and he always kept bringing up hospitalizations. So in Miami-Dade, we now see hospitalizations going up. What does that tell us?
I'll tell you a little bit of good news, and so much of this is bad news, that I did see that today, according to the Agency for Healthcare Administration, all four counties that we focus on, Monroe, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach, there's now a 28.9% of available adult ICU beds. And that's actually somewhat increased from yesterday. So experts do think that at the moment, Florida has the ICU hospital bed capacity to handle any surge in cases. But if there's a huge spike that continues in cases and not a containment measure, then it's possible that the hospital system would be overwhelmed.
And what happens with individuals who are coming in with influenza-like symptoms who haven't been confirmed to have COVID? What are they doing with them?
Well, that's a great question that the state doesn't have data, doesn't have specific hospitalization data available, just a general number. Whereas in Miami-Dade County, it is broken down and there is, the numbers, you know, they do offer that information of people coming in with influenza type symptoms. Whether they're counted, you know, I guess it depends if they test positive to be counted for COVID-19. But that is a very important piece that's missing from statewide numbers.
I'm talking with Veronica Zaragovia, WLRN's new healthcare reporter. Florida's coronavirus cases continue to rise, along with more than 20 states across the country. You can find more of Veronica's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So, Veronica, deaths are trending down. What does that tell us?
Yes, and, you know, even though there's been an increase in the number of deaths recorded from yesterday, Sunday, to today, Monday, overall, the trajectory of deaths has been declining. And experts have said that that's because at this point in the pandemic, the state has a better management in terms of, you know, there were a lot of another hospital, these isolation centers where people who test positive, mostly the people who live in long-term facilities, can go and recover before going back to their homes. And so I lost my train of thought.
That's all right. So the deaths are trending down.
Yes. Okay. So the deaths are trending down. So basically, yeah, in that regard, you know, we've got a better management than we did in mid-March when things were changing by the day.
So at a press conference on Saturday, the governor said that most people with new infections are younger adults who don't have any symptoms of the disease and generally don't require hospitalizations. Is that true?
So basically what's interesting is that the governor wanted to host a press conference for context. And so it is true that people that the average age is trending down, younger patients testing positive. The problem is that a lot of, you know, these people could be asymptomatic in these certain, let's say, 25 to 40 year olds, but that doesn't mean that they're not able to spread the coronavirus that causes the COVID-19 disease. And so there needs to now be more focus on how to get these younger individuals to follow what experts ask us to do in order to help contain these numbers.
So what are the side effects of COVID-19 for younger people who test positive?
A lot of times they don't have, you know, chances that they would end up on a ventilator. That percentage is quite low. But it doesn't mean that it's not a serious disease. Over the weekend, a 17-year-old died from COVID-19 and it wasn't a travel-related case in Florida. And so people need to take this seriously, because also while even if you're asymptomatic, but you are positive for COVID-19 by particles spreading from your mouth or nose into someone who is older, let's say 65 and above, or has comorbidities and could face more dire consequences, then that gets very serious.
Now, some people that test positive are asymptomatic, and a new study says that people in this situation can be reinfected. What does that mean?
Right. So that the importance of that is that at the beginning, we were seeing people believe that, okay, if you've tested positive and you recovered, now you can go out into the community and go back to work. And what that's saying is that actually people might get infected again multiple times. And so you're not immune forever from COVID-19 because you've had it once.
And that's something that some people believed. And we heard the governor even say at one point, you know, if you've got it, you're fine, which now we're finding out what the truth is. You spoke with an infectious disease expert recently about measures that could be taken to avoid the spread of this coronavirus. What did she say?
Yeah, so I had spoken to Dr. Eileen Marty at FIU. She's an infectious diseases specialist, and she had some suggestions like hold your sign, but perhaps don't speak loudly the message, or use a megaphone instead of shouting. And the reason being that although people feel very passionately about their beliefs, that that's how you spread the disease through the particles from the mouth and the nose, that's the biggest way to spread it. And so she suggested those measures and of course wearing masks. Not just people are wearing them like under their chin in case they need to pull it up. Like, no, you need to be covering your nose and your mouth and not touching the mask, because then you're getting, your hands are not necessarily always clean. And speaking of hands, you should be washing them as much as possible for at least 20 seconds and standing those 6 feet apart.
And again, that's for people who have been taking part in these demonstrations. Again, keep your mask on, as she said. And if you're going, if you have to speak loudly, use a megaphone. It always helps. Again, right. Talking with Veronica Zaragovia, WLRN's new healthcare reporter. Veronica, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Well, still to come, the largest foster home in Florida is facing a coronavirus outbreak. What's being done to protect foster children? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Tens of thousands of children live in foster homes across Florida, awaiting adoption. But the coronavirus pandemic has upended the process for families and has prevented thousands of children from leaving neglected and abusive homes for foster care. There's also grave concern for virus spread within these facilities. Last week, the Miami Herald reported 11 children and 7 staff members at his house tested positive for COVID-19. The for-profit foster home near Miami Gardens is the largest in the state. Kurt Kelly is the CEO of the Florida Coalition for Children, a nonprofit organization based in Tallahassee that supports foster care systems, and he joins us now. Mr. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Mr. Kelly, how vulnerable are foster homes to coronavirus outbreaks, as we've seen with his house here in Miami-Dade?
Well, and thank you for asking that and presenting it in the right light. I can tell you that just like anyone is this is a very infectious disease, and we have to take all the appropriate steps. There's really sort of two groups that you can look at that we are addressing specifically, and that is our foster families. So we have foster families that end up having children that come into the system, and they come into their single person home or family home. And then we have these group homes, like you mentioned, his house and others. These are our group cares, and they take care of, probably spend more time with youth. They do a lot more with youth and that type of thing. So, but both are very vulnerable. And so when we first began to hear about the coronavirus, they didn't call it COVID-19, but called it the coronavirus, when it first started coming out, I think we had our first conversation about putting together our continuity of operations plan of addressing how would what would we do if this thing began to really grow and be as severe as we were hearing. And of course, early on, back in January and February, no one was really quite sure about this. But I think we got out ahead of this. And quite frankly, Florida did a really good job with our foster families and our group homes. We had very low incidence of people having COVID and actually getting COVID from other folks and so forth. We put a lot of things to distance ourselves and keeping folks from coming in and putting a barrier around this. And I think Florida did a good job in that respect.
What are the safety protocols that are in place that are supposed to prevent what we saw again at his house?
And again, you'd have to understand what happened actually with his house. There was a couple of kids that, I mean, again, these are tough environments for a lot of our youth, and you have youth that have been traumatized in a lot of ways, and sometimes they will leave, they will run, they'll do a variety of things, and I think that's some of the stuff that took place in that situation. Again, that's more of an anomaly than it is the rule that we see. Here's what we did. We came in and almost immediately said, we're going to make sure we limit contact. And we started social distancing before that was really even a word that was being used out there. We knew that we had to keep people in distance from each other. Especially inside a group home, if there was not any evidence, or inside a foster home, there was no evidence that anyone had a cold or anything of that nature, what we try to do is limit people coming and having contact with them. And
so we limit visitations,
but we didn't stop visitations. What we did is we used a different tool. We used teleaccess, and we really put together a lot of a very robust strategy on allowing families to see their kids in foster care, to see have our case managers do a lot of contact through the teleaccess and have conversations. And this has been a really interesting, because we didn't do this before. It wasn't something that the federal government wasn't in favor of it, the state government was in favor of it. But when we started doing this, and we've really learned some great lessons that, especially with a lot of the younger generation, and I say folks that are in their 30s, even 40s, are actually very adept at having these kind of communication processes. And so we found that there was a very much appreciative to be able to keep our eyes on children, have those conversations, to be able but also while we're keeping those eyes on those children, but also be able to limit the physical contacts and to keep them in a safe environment like that. And quite frankly, did very well. Now with all of this kind of reopening, we are having those conversations again, saying we need to be very cautious of this. Just because they're starting to reopen in a lot of areas doesn't mean that we can just do away with all of the caution that we put in place.
Is there a testing apparatus for foster homes, especially the bigger ones?
Are you talking about like if they have COVID, a testing apparatus like that?
Well, yeah, even testing in general. What's the testing like for staff and but also for the kids?
Yeah, I was going to tell you, this is an area I wish that we had a greater opportunity. Again, the whole testing process is done through the state and through the CDC. They put the rules and regulations in that. It's been an area that I've been concerned about as the CEO and president of the coalition. We've had multiple conversations with key folks, including the department, about making sure that we get the opportunity to have adequate testing. Early on, we didn't. Early on, we didn't get access to a lot of this, but a lot of people didn't. And so I think that we are now starting to get more access to testing. It's more available. But not at the level I think it should be. I wish the state would open up point of contact testing, where they've got tests right now that you can do. You could have a result whether you had COVID, and some of the ones I looked at were 96-97% accurate, just as accurate as the nasal swabs. And they don't have to go to a laboratory like Quest or LabCorp. They can be done, and within 2 to 4 minutes or 2 to 6 minutes, you can know if you actually that person that was tested has COVID, and then you could immediately take them and isolate them and so forth. I wish they would go down that path open that door, but they don't.
Well, why haven't they? I mean, because you said the state did a good job, but is this where they fell behind? Was on the testing?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, in my opinion, that I think that they, and I'm, by the way, that's not just me saying that. There's a lot of people that have been saying that, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce came out and said that they ought to be just having this massive, robust testing, whether it's nasal swabs, whether it's a serology test, which is the blood draw, or whether it's little pinprick tests that you can do and do things that can show you very quickly. They were recommending that. I think we did I don't know how many we did last year. I saw the president say that we've done like 30 million tests. They were suggesting, the U.S. Chamber was suggesting that we do 30 million tests a week. That we do, and we to do that
nationwide.
You wouldn't be doing, yeah, nationwide. Here in Florida, I don't know what that would be, but I do believe that testing could be something that we could do better at, and that way we would know if someone has the. The virus, and then you could quarantine them immediately and not allow them to be in this environment where they could be infecting a lot of folks and just not know. And so I think that's an area. But put that aside, I think the many things that we did and our organizations across with the Florida Coalition for Children and all of our lead agencies and our providers, we really got into social distancing and putting right policies and procedures in place early on.
So you have you're doing everything that the CDC has set in its guidelines to try to protect the staff and the children. But I want to know how this pandemic has disrupted the day-to-day operations for both foster care facilities, but also for the Department of Children and Families. How has it changed everything?
I think there's a couple things that I don't know it's changed everything, but it certainly has. Cause some areas that we are concerned about, and I would think that it's fair to bring this up at this point in time. One of the things that happens in our arena is, again, the way this system of care works is that if someone sees something, and usually they're mandatory reporters, people like school teachers. And that's where a lot of our reporting comes from, is from the education world. They'll see something, they'll go to the right place, they'll have it reported. The Department of Children and Families will then send a CPI out to do the investigation work. When they find out that there may be abuse, abandonment, or neglect that's taken place, and they meet a criteria, that's when they can remove the child. Here's the hard part. We have lost those eyes on those children right now. And so we're not even sure. I mean, again, these are
because they can't go to the homes.
Well, they're not seeing the kids. Their kids aren't going to school. They're not able to see them.
Yeah. I mean,
well, no. The CPIs can go to the home if they know about it.
Okay.
They just don't even know about it. So it's a question of have we had our eyes on it? And we believe that if and when school opens up, let's say it opens up in the fall, we believe that we're going to probably see a dramatic increase in cases that are going to be brought to our attention. And we're trying to prepare ourselves for that right now. So we haven't had as many kids coming into care. And again, I think that's a function of the fact that we're just not able to lay the eyes on them through the mandatory reporters. But it's the second thing that I think has been important is just the fact that in these environments, and I can tell you that I think this is a positive thing. We thought that it was going to bring a lot of stress to the kids. It gave us an opportunity to really spend time with them. I mean, and even educationally, there was a lot of tutoring taking place, sort of more what I would call family activities. And we think that that's been a very positive effect on this. I'm looking forward to trying to look at some of our we've got a group of folks saying, let's study and say, what did we learn out of COVID? What were some of the better practices that we should continue to purport before the legislature in the future?
And still learning, because this may last quite a while. Again, talking with Kurt Kelly, CEO of the Florida Coalition for Children. This is a nonprofit organization that's operated as a support system for children in need for 60 years now. Last week, as mentioned, the Miami Herald reported 11 children, 7 staff members at his house tested positive for COVID-19. We've reached out to his house for comment. We're still awaiting their response. So, Mr. Kelly, the coronavirus cases, again, hit the foster system hard. An estimated 10,000 fewer children went through the foster care in May compared to the May of last year. What are the circumstances? Remind us of the circumstances in which a child would be admitted into foster care in the first place.
Well, again, I use the terms we try to work with abuse. So obviously, when you see abuse, and that would be very evident, it's that they when a case a child protection investigator goes in and evaluates it, if they see physical abuse and so forth, that's pretty evident there. And those children would be then removed and placed into a foster home, or in some cases into a residential care, depending on the level of severity and the trauma. We also look at certainly abandonment. If someone has just left the children there immediately, the state then takes those and hands those to a foster family or a residential care organization. And by the way, while I'm also saying that, that's when it comes into our side. We also look to try to get it with their kin. We have a whole process that has a kinship that we will make sure to try to get them to kin first if we could. And then if there is a neglect, and I would say something like 65% to 70% of our kids that come into care are often done because the children have been neglected. And I won't spend the time here going into the multiple of values that we evaluate on that, but a child that has been not being fed properly or having neglect issues. And again, a lot of the situations we're in is there's a lot of alcohol and drug abuse that's taking place in that home, and therefore they evaluate that.
What's your concern then that because of the pandemic, that these cases may be a lot higher than what we're seeing right now? Because as you pointed out, once we get back to school, you might see a real big jump again because we're going to start to see the kids again.
So the problem is, and if that is the case, and again, that may be an assertion on my part. I'm hoping I'm wrong. Let me just say this for the record. I hope that we don't see this situation. But it stands to reason, since we're going to have people who are usually having their eyes on this and see this, we'll probably start seeing those increases. There are some that are arguing that's not going to be the case, but we'll see. But if it does, the way it comes into our system is Florida has a no eject, no reject process. In other words, once we get a child in there, we can't say, well, we're full, we can't take any more. We have to take them, we have to find them, we have to find good foster homes, we have to make sure we have the right places for them, depending on their need. And so whenever there's a spike that comes at one time, it can strain the system across the state of Florida. We've seen that over a couple of examples in the past where things like that have happened. So we're trying to prepare ourselves for that, making sure that we have a sufficient body of foster families ready to be able to take on the overload if it's the case. And so we'll be prepared for that. Here's the bad news. The bad news, all of that costs money to do all of that. And a lot of the ways that we are funded comes from some federal, but also a lot of state general revenue, and the state is going to be hurting with general revenue. So this is almost a perfect storm for some big challenges for us.
Well, yeah, and considering that, what is your biggest concern if that's the case? Because the governor's going to have a red pen. There's going to be a lot of cuts.
Yeah. Well, I'm thankful that we have a good relationship in Tallahassee to talk with the governor and explain our needs and making sure they understand that, we get the right resources. The great thing about Florida has a community-based care model. This community-based care, no other state has it quite like we have it. We went from one of the worst provisions of services 20 years ago to one of the best in America today, and we still have a long way to go. But that means we usually get the community deeply involved. So we're not just going to look at the legislature and say, give us a bunch more money if they don't have it. We'll continue to work and do all the things we do in our local communities to make sure our communities are helping take care of these kids.
This leads to this question I have for you, because, having a child removed from a family, it could be the worst case scenario. It depends on the situation, though. Your mission is to try to keep kids out of the foster system. So how have you been working with your community partners to address some of those root causes that prevents that from happening?
When I first came here 7.5 years ago, I told them, I said, you know, I'm not coming here to bolster a child welfare system that continues to pull kids out of their home and sticks them into another home, because that traumatizes the child no matter what you do, even if it's the right thing to do, even if it's to keep them safe and from harm. Our reality is we would love to be able to work with that child and that family so that they can continue to be reunited and stay together. We may pull them out for a period of time and then put them back into their home. And that takes a lot of work. And that's where community-based care has earned its stripes in a lot of respects, is we do work with a variety of players and philanthropic organizations and faith-based groups to try to help these families in their times of crisis and try not to re-traumatize these children.
But Mr. Kelly, for you, I'm wondering, is there I'm sure it's a case-by-case situation, but, you know, what's the line for you when you say, you know what, I can help this family and keep that kid in that house, or that kid's got to get out. To save that child, I cannot leave them there.
Well, safety starts. The first thing is safety. I mean, we look at it, and if that child is not going to be safe there, then they have to be removed. I mean, and that becomes quite clear. I mean, if a child is abandoned, well, they're not going to be safe wherever they are. You're going to make sure we have someone to help them. We're not just trying to offer three hots and a cot. We want to put them in a family environment as much as we possibly can, whether it be in one of our great foster homes or one of our great residential group homes. And we put them in that environment to try to give them that protection and that safety. But our goal is to try to get back with the family. And, you know, this is why we're working a lot with our mental health and our substance abuse organizations out there, because there's a lot of issues in that. And if we can address many of those issues, then we can have them back into their environment where the child can thrive. And so you said it. There is no easy answer to this. There's no one size fits all. There's no rule that you can put in place that says it's always like this, because it's not always like it. Every child is different. Every family situation can be different. And so we have to be adaptable and work in that. Again, that's why communities are really important. I have an office in Tallahassee. I'm up there. I have a home in Ocala, and I'm right now socially distanced here in Ocala. And that's a lot different than from Fort Lauderdale or Miami. Different cultures, different communities. But their communities know how to address those children and those families in their environment. And that, I think that's one of our strengths here in Florida. We've done a good job in that respect.
Let me finish with this, because I go back to something you said earlier, is that so you had these conversations in January. You were a little bit ahead of the curve. But now, so here we are again in the reopening, and we're seeing this uptick in coronavirus cases. So what are these conversations that you're having now, you know, to make sure that you keep everybody safe?
Yes, you're right. We did get out ahead of everybody else. I have usually a call early on Monday mornings with about probably 200 people across our system of care. And we were talking about being adaptable, pay attention to what's going on in your community. Listen, some areas, my Ocala area doesn't have a big uptick at this at all. But you get down in the South Florida area, the big three counties down there in that area, Miami-Dade, and certainly Broward and Palm Beach County, and they're going to have to be very adaptable to the way that they continue to socially distance, the way they continue to use some of the processes that we've used, and be very sensitive about their staff, making sure that their staff is given the right PPEs and that they're given all the right materials to be able to protect them. That's been one of the big things that we've really worked on, was to make sure that we're providing. The coalition got into this whole PPE world because we weren't getting those things, and we got out there and tried to really bring in a lot of the necessary equipment so our folks could have it and be and protect our children.
Well, let's hope that we can continue to do so as we move forward. Kurt Kelly, CEO of the Florida Coalition for Children. Mr. Kelly, thanks so much for the time and the information.
My honor. I appreciate you having me.
All right, and stay safe. I want to mention, by the way, we have to make a quick correction, a slight error in our previous conversation with our healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. The positivity rate, as we had spoke about, refers to the number of positive coronavirus cases divided by the number of tests administered. So just to clear that up, our apologies for making that mistake. Well, still to come, how do you shoot a commercial while social distancing? We're going to learn about film and TV production here during a pandemic. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, South Florida in recent years has welcomed a number of high-profile film projects, from the Oscar-winning film Moonlight to the Return of the Bad Boys franchise with Will Smith. But the pandemic put production of new film and television projects on hold until very recently. The film industry is big business in Florida. The Office of Film and Entertainment found that from 2010 to 2016, $1.25 billion were generated from productions here. Sandy Leiterman is the Miami-Dade County Film and Entertainment Commissioner. She joins us now. Ms. Leiterman, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I'm curious, how many projects were going on before the pandemic? Do you know? Was there any big project happening down here?
There were talk of a lot of big projects happening right around May, and those were all put on hold. There were a lot of large commercials happening at the time, which had to shut down. So, we missed out on a lot of local economic stimulus because of COVID.
So now that things are starting to reopen, I mean, how many companies and production groups are calling about applying for those permits?
Well, I will tell you that even during the time that we were not issuing film permits, that we were busy, extremely busy about, you know, what the future would hold and about inquiring about production. We started issuing film permits again on May 18th, and we're getting very busy. We have a couple pages of film permits, and they're mostly commercials and music videos currently, but hoping that some of the smaller feature films will come back and consider what they were going to be doing before this all hit us.
And so we have to live in this world of restrictions, you know, with social distancing and masks and everything else.
Yes.
How is that impacting the ability to film projects?
Well, I want to tell you, so, you know, this, the industry in itself is a very resilient industry and very, very smart. So since the epidemic started, everybody started discussing how is this going to work? And there's different ways to make it happen because each project is different. But besides the, whether it be a county, state, or, you know, municipal, mandates, there are guidelines on how to actually, their guidelines have been put out by Film Florida, which is a nonprofit organization for the state. The unions have and guilds have put out mandates and guidelines. So it's working. It's you know, a little slow on the start. Things are a little more complicated. There has to be a lot more pre-production, so a lot more pre-planning involved. Can't make it changes like you could before. A lot more things are being done remotely, like directors remotely. Even production meetings are done remotely. Zoom is obviously, and others like that are really doing well. And the technology is helping move it along.
Do they have to have like smaller crews perhaps, or and what about testing? Are they testing all the folks?
It depends on the project. On longer projects, they are testing. The studios are definitely, but tests are required before people are hired, before cast and crew are hired. Yes. So there's a couple of reasons besides the fact that, you know, in especially Miami-Dade County, we have to have, you know, fewer than 10, right, in a group. So yes, the crews have to reduce, but it's also you know, in that reduction, it's also because of it's taking more time, it's costing more money. Yeah. So all of those sort of it's kind of a puzzle that's just it's being worked out practically on set as we speak.
I wonder if you've heard anything about this, but you know, there are certain states where the numbers are going up, like ours. The numbers are going up. Yes. I'm wondering if that's scaring people away.
Well, you know, it is a part of the discussion, but a lot of things that we say, and which is true, if you look at our map, there are places that are hot spots and there are places that are not. So when you're directing, when this is being asked and we're talking about certain locations, we will talk about those. We talk about what those hot spots and we're usually asked about them. And so that's how it's being tailored to still attract production here.
No, because I mean, Miami-Dade and Broward are two of the worst. How do you get around that? I mean,
again, you talk about it and you speak about what a production is looking for. For example, if they were going to shoot something in the middle of a city, like or downtown somewhere where it's going to be, there's a hotspot. Let's find a location. Let's help you, which is what our office does. Help you find a location that will be similar, not in a hotspot.
I'm talking with Sandy Leiterman, Miami-Dade County's Film and Entertainment Commissioner. The county has started issuing permits to begin shooting again, music videos, commercials, the opportunity for films. If you're involved in the film or music industry, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Tell us, you know, are things starting to pick back up? Remind us, Ms. Leiterman, of the impact of, you know, film industry here in Miami-Dade.
The economic impact is pretty big, even without a statewide incentive. You know, the minimal is between $150 and $200 million a year in direct spend into the local economy, including, obviously, job creation.
So when a project comes in, it's basically, I mean, it's they're staying in our hotels, they're eating in our restaurants, but it's also they're hiring local people.
Yes, and even more so with what's happened with the pandemic, they're actually hiring more local people because things are being done remotely. So less people, you know, some people are coming in. Unfortunately, less people are coming in for the hotel situation, but that's also there's also a possibility of lots of people coming into a hotel situation, and that's because there's a initiative from the Greater Miami Convention Visitors Bureau to make that happen, which is called PracticeSafeSetsMiami.com.
Practice Safe Sets. Okay.
Miami. So let me tell you a little bit about that because okay. It's pretty cool. So the Greater Miami Convention Visitors Bureau reached out to the hotels in Miami-Dade County to talk about what they would offer if a production would want to come in from outside. A whole production coming in, whether hiring locally or otherwise, to have what they call quarantine or sequester production, which is what's happened in Australia and Iceland, as well as it's being discussed in Hollywood, global Hollywood, and it's happening starting next month in July in Georgia. And that's where everybody stays in one place, they shoot in one place, and then they go, you know, and repeat every single day the same kind of thing. So working with the Greater Miami Convention Visitor Bureau, they worked with the hotels to talk to them about making their hotels basically a studio, a back lot, so to speak, having the productions stay there, having them shoot on location there, building their sets in the ballrooms, that kind of thing. And that's something that's very interesting to Hollywood, and it's just getting out there. It literally just launched last week. So,
and that's an interesting point, because sometimes with these projects, a film will come in, they'll do a little bit of filming in the city, even if the movie supposedly takes place in Miami, they may come in, film a little bit, but then film the rest of it somewhere else. So this is a way to get crews to stay. You know, you talk about the tax incentive. So this is fascinating, because years ago, like, it seemed like every state was offering tax incentives for Hollywood to come to their state. And then, you know, it, when everybody's offering it, then it doesn't mean anything. So a lot of states got rid of it. Georgia, Louisiana, still probably the biggest states for filming. But why is Florida, why do lawmakers not see this as a plus and not offer more incentives?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I can answer that question. But, you know, I can tell you that we, of course, every year we go back and we actually ask, meaning as an industry, ask to consider bringing some kind of job creation program back to Florida so that we can compete. Now, if everybody else at every one of those other states, especially Georgia, Louisiana, did not have an incentive, we wouldn't have to worry about it. But, you know, I equate this all the time. I say if Winn-Dixie and Publix are having a sale, whoever's having the sale, that's where you're going. And that's kind of the same thing with this industry. You know, it's about dollars and cents. But interestingly, right now, of course, you know, there's also the safety factor. That's also, you know, I want to say factored in too. So being safe, as well as having an incentive to actually to offset costs of PPE and other things that have to happen, is the new thing. But and, you know, we're still interested, of course, in being able to compete on the front of some kind of jump stimulus program.
Now you know that's about trying to attract the big Hollywood productions and more not just the big ones, but all kinds of projects to this area. But what's happening right now when it comes to local productions, like for example Moonlight? I mean, those are locals, you know. Are you seeing that grow?
Well, we are, because we have a local incentive program that has been thankfully Mayor Jimenez and Commissioner Sally Heyman actually spearheaded the effort, and of course it was approved by all of the whole commission, a program that started in 2017 to bring in productions like, not Moonlight didn't have an incentive, but others like that. And we have two tiers of that, and that's $1 million plus spend for $100,000 rebate. And then there's a second tier of $500,000 spend for $500,000, to under $1 million spend for a $50,000 rebate, but very Miami centric. Caveats. You have to shoot 70% of the project in Miami-Dade County. You have to hire a certain amount of residents from beginning to end of production without, you know, straight through, as well as you have to hire 70% of your businesses have to be Miami-Dade County businesses. So it's very centric to a return on investment to the county and county residents.
Ms. Leiderman, what do you think is going to change with the film industry because of this pandemic?
Well, I actually think it's interesting. So we talk about this a lot. I think that sets will get safer, and I think that the resilience will change some of the processes to make them more efficient. Maybe, you know, spending less money in the long run on things and then not spending money on things that you don't need. You know, and that sometimes that happens in the industry. For high level talent, a lot of extras, and that might be a change here, and it might not, but I do see it moving in a positive direction for change, especially in how organized it is.
Well, you know what? This is South Florida. It's a unique place. There is no other place like it. If they want shots of our beaches and our landscape, they got to come down here, because you're not finding it anywhere else. So, yeah. Sandy Leiderman, again, Miami-Dade County's Film and Entertainment Commissioner. Ms. Leiderman, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for having us and supporting the industry.
Fantastic. And again, if you're involved in film or the music industry, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial and let us know. How is it changing because of the pandemic? We'd love to hear your side of it as well. Well, that's our program for this Monday, June 22nd. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, we're going to get an update on antibody testing happening in South Florida, whether you should trust your results and what is it and doesn't tell us about immunity. plus how businesses are being monitored to ensure that the virus doesn't spread at gyms and restaurants and bars. Plus, we're going to learn about the conversations around criminal justice reform in Palm Beach County. Our reporter Wilkin Brutus sat in on a Juneteenth forum last week, and he'll also tell us about Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson's visit to Palm Beach yesterday. And finally, young people leading the fight against climate change, inspired by Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. The new podcast from the Clio Institute, House on Fire, explores how the climate crisis is impacting South Florida. We're going to meet two Gen Zers who host the podcast. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. Really appreciate it. Again, remember, you can always find us online, WLRN.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think of the program. And if you missed it, it's on at 8 o'clock again. Or if you want to listen on your own time, find the podcast on iTunes or any of your podcast apps. Again, I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.